This is word of mouth from NHPR. The English language is remarkable for its rich vocabulary. There are twice as many English words in common use than in French, and it's the only language that has or needs a thesaurus. Yet sometimes English words fail us, at least when it comes to love. If you are searching for that single, perfect word to express the euphoria you experience when first falling in love, for example, you may do better to use the Norwegian forelsket. Historian and writer Pamela Haag created the Marriage 3.0 blog for the Big Think website. She's compiled a top 10 list of foreign words describing the nuances of love and friendships. Pamela, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Your posts on 10 relationship words that aren't translatable into English got a really big response from readers. Any idea why it was so popular?
Yeah, a few reasons, I think. When it comes to love and relationships and desire, I think a lot of us have had that experience of not getting precisely the nuance in the word that we want. So we're trying to talk to our friends about an experience, and they're throwing out some words, and it's like, well, it wasn't exactly like that. So I think around relationships in particular, we really crave very precise and nuanced words. And personally, I'm always interested in looking at how some of the things that we take as kind of timeless and universal, like love and the emotions of love, how those things can have very specific cultural inflections and meanings. So I'm always interested in the anthropological elements of doing some cultural comparisons of things that we often think are beyond words, like our feelings.
I agree. I mean, some of these words do seem so universal, while others reveal sort of particular ideas to a culture, like the Chinese term that you have here. It looks like one fen. What does that mean?
Right. This is a very complex concept, even for native Chinese speakers. It's a relationship by fate or destiny. So it draws on an idea of predetermination, that there are certain relationships or infinities that are kind of dictated. We're bound to meet certain people. But it doesn't actually mean that we're destined to be with those people. Even if we're fated to find them, we may not end up together. So that really cracks open a whole cultural element of a culture that has, you know, some very ancient ideas of predetermination and a concept of fate, but also a real concept of human agency, that even if we're in some ways fated to meet, we can, in the Chinese proverb, have fate without destiny. Hmm. We might not end up together.
Another really interesting term here, yabrni, I don't know how to pronounce it, an Arabic word. What does it mean?
Oh, yes, I know. My apologies, too, for pronunciation.
Listeners can read them online.
Exactly. They can check out the column at Big Think. This is a term that literally means you bury me. So it's a declaration of a lover's hope that they'll die before the other person, because how could they live without them? And I like this term because it seemed like it was described by someone online as morbid and beautiful, and I think that gets it. And it seems like a slightly more poetic or sophisticated expression of that phrase in English, how could I live without you? You know, this seems a little more serious and poetic than our phrase.
Do you have a favorite that you'd like to see worked into the English vernacular?
Well, one that I really love, which is, of course, the most unpronounceable of all, is from the Yagan language.
Oh, is that the mummy la hapentinipape? I'm sorry. All of the Jurgen speakers out there, I really do apologize.
I know. Agreed. It's, yeah, mummy la pinatape, I think is how it's pronounced, but this, I think, is a lovely word, and it means the wordless but meaningful look that's shared by two people who both desire to start something but are reluctant to do it. And to me, that just captured that delicious moment when you're kind of on the start of a seduction or a new relationship, and you both know that you want to do something, but there's all that hesitancy before anyone actually does anything. So I thought that was a lovely word to have to describe a very poignant moment in a relationship.
Yes, it's absolutely wonderful. And I'm wondering here, is this why maybe there are so many terrific romantic and love poems in English, you know, filling in those gaps that we don't get in our language?
Yeah, that could be. You know, it is very interesting to consider why these words, because the concepts we all recognize once we hear the word, but there really isn't a good equivalent in English at all. And it does make you wonder what different cultures decide to focus on when it comes to relationships and love, and which moments they kind of dignify with their own word.
We're speaking with historian and writer Pamela Haag. She created the Marriage 3.0 blog for the Big Think website, and she's put together a top 10 list of foreign words describing the nuances of love and relationships that, you know, can't really have a translation in English, but that has gone hyper-viral. I guess a lot of people are looking for it. Two of my favorites from Brazilian Portuguese here, kafune and saudade. First, kafune.
Oh, yeah. That is the act of tenderly running your fingers through someone's hair.
Aww.
Which, again, I know, I love that. And, you know, what took me 10 words to describe, they managed to encapsulate in one, and a very beautiful word, too.
I wonder where it came from.
I don't know. I mean, I wonder if it's that, you know, certain cultures have more affection for hair than we do, and they spend more time thinking about that. And the last one is Portuguese, and that's a feeling of longing for someone that you love and is lost. But one thing that interested me about this word is that it could also accommodate that vague desire for something that doesn't even exist. So I like that word because it can incorporate or accommodate both a lost love, but also sort of a magical realism, a kind of love that you are never going to have, or a person that's never going to exist. But it leaves us in the same heartbroken state, you know, whether it's someone we've lost or someone that we will never have.
All right. So while we don't have mami halapinatape, we do have some new relationship words, according to the OED anyway. What are those?
Yes, we do. The OED just this year introduced a slightly less poignant term. Sexting has now made it into the OED.
Wow.
I know. So it's somebody now. And I think we all know what that means. Bromance was introduced last year, and that's an affectionate, not really sexual, but kind of crush-like relationship between two men. So we are adding new words. Technology is exploding, you know, exponentially, the number of words that are added that have to do with relationships.
Well, one of the premises of your book, Marriage Confidential, this was published in the spring, and your blog, Marriage 3.0, is that we are in this post-romantic era, and that marriage is in a brainstorming phase. You know, you come up with some relationship terms of your own to describe these new realities and a new sort of vocabulary. Why is it necessary?
Well, I think that words not only help us organize the things that we see around us and things that are new and make sense out of all of the chaos of individual relationships, but I also think they really encourage us to have a richer set of thoughts about relationships. So I think it's very reciprocal. I think when we have a vocabulary to describe something, we can have more complex ideas as well. Richer vocabulary leads to richer and more precise thoughts. So to that end, in Marriage Confidential, I did try to get a sense of some of the trends in marriage today and to come up with some terms to capture some of the new realities of marriage.
Well, give me parenting marriage. I thought that was interesting. Define that for us.
Oh, yeah. The co-parenting marriage is one that's very much defined, almost exclusively, the major goal is to raise the children. I mean, children are, of course, always important in marriage, but in these marriages, the children are really kind of at the center of the marriage alone as the big goal. And that term really just emerged out of conversations I was having where husbands and wives were saying, you know, really the point of this marriage for me is to raise these children, and that is absolutely the priority. It wasn't, you know, economic dependency or other things that used to be part of marriage. It was very much about those children. So I came up with that term to describe those relationships.
Okay, so next time we'll talk to you about how they'd translate that into other languages. But I want to thank you for today, Pamela.
Thank you very much.
Pamela Haag, historian, writer, and former research director at the American Association of University Women. There are links to more on her book, Marriage Confidential, The Post-Romantic Age of Workhorse Wives, Royal Children, Undersexed Spouses, and Rebel Couples Who Are Rewriting the Rules, and her Marriage 3.0 blog at Big Think. You'll find those at wordofmouthradio.org. We want to thank Louisa Burdett for her work on this segment, and extra special thanks to Rob St. Pierre for his ongoing production help. Now, later in the show, we're going to talk about some of the less adoring things exchanged between couples, namely contests over who carries the load on the holiday chore scorecard. Stay with us for that, and a reimagining of the soundtrack of Fritz Lang's silent film Metropolis, That's when word of mouth strikes up the band again after the news from the BBC.
Na dança da solidão, Camélia ficou viúva, Joana.